Welcome to the Healthy Seas Podcast, a show about what we need to do to have just that, healthy seas and a healthy future. I'm your host, Crystal DiMicelli, and in each episode, we talk about the problems facing the seas and oceans and the solutions we have to fix them. Come on in, the water's fine. Today I'm with Duncan Simpson, the North Coordinator for Ghost Diving UK, and Andrew Jack, a fisherman from Birkenhead, Scotland, and we're going to be talking about a huge undertaking that the two collaborated in to remove over 600 lobster pots lost at sea. Hi Duncan and Andy, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi Crystal, thanks for having us.
I recently took a trip to Scotland, and so I feel like I have an even greater context as to what we'll be talking about today, and an appreciation for what you did. To give the listener some context, can you tell us what happened this past winter?
Okay, so we were fishing for lobsters and crabs, mainly lobsters at this time of year. It was in the build-up to the, on the run-up to the Christmas market, which means prices are the highest they are all year, although there's not very many lobsters on the go. So we had over 600 pots in the water. We've seen the forecast that it was going to be a bad gale of wind coming in, Storm Arwen, so we spread out the gear and then sort of hoped for the best, but we never foreseen just exactly how bad this storm was going to be and the damage that was caused by it. So even with the gear all spread out, basically bunched up like a bunch of grapes, we weren't able to recover with the boat. We only managed to get maybe 50 to 80 up the boat, and then we realised that we weren't going to be able to recover this gear without the help of Ghost Diving UK.
So tell me a little bit more about this storm. Why was it different than what you usually experience?
We've been fishing through storms before. Obviously, we've not been out in the boat during the storms with the fishing gears left at sea. Sometimes you get some damage that the creels sort of double back on themselves, but we're able to haul that up on the boat, clear that issues, and then shoot them out again. But this storm, Arwen, it was gusting over 90 mile an hour here. It's the worst I can ever remember, the worst storm I can ever remember. Some of the gear actually moved 4 or 5 miles from where it was set. So it was just really, really powerful force. And there was not really anything we could have done differently to avoid that other than taking in all the fishing gear. But to take in 600 odd pots would have took us probably a couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks before that. So we didn't have the luxury of that forecast previously.
Yeah. And like I mentioned, I was in Scotland last week. What I saw when I was there were hundreds and hundreds of downed trees and huge patches of ecosystems that were impacted. And that was only on the land. Like what you're saying is that even in the ocean, even in the waters, there were huge impacts from the storm.
Massive, yeah. I remember one of the nights that Storm Arwen was happening, there was roads all around here that was closed. I was trying over to get over to Birkenhead just to check on the boats. I managed to get between Hopeman and Birkenhead easy enough, but the road from Birkenhead up to Elgin was actually closed, which is just a town maybe 7 miles from Birkenhead. All the trees in the road had been blown over, and that road was actually blocked off. There was a lot of trees, damages to roof, damages to cars, properties. There was a lot of stuff damaged around about this area. And then obviously we had damage to the fishing gear.
I think you said that it was 90 mile an hour winds. Is that correct? Because if that's the case, I mean, that's hurricane force winds.
Yeah, I think it was gusting over 90 miles an hour. I'd need to check online, but I'm pretty sure it was gusting over 90 miles an hour in some parts.
And that's not common?
No, that's not common for around here, no.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so you said you spread out your gear, and that usually is what works with storms, but they all just bunched up and floated far away, which is crazy. I mean, I want to ask you how you even find them to begin with, but before you even consider finding them, going through the trouble of finding them, wouldn't it be cheaper just to buy new ones? Like, why retrieve those?
Yeah, I suppose you could have done that. It was a lot of money to lose. Not only that, a lot of that gear was tangled up on fishing grounds that not only we work, there's maybe another 6 or 8 boats work there. So if I just left that gear, it would have affected a lot of people. They wouldn't have been able to fish there. or if they did try and fish there, possibly their gear would get caught up in it. It was really just beneficial, and not to mention also the ghost fishing that's involved in that lost gear. We didn't know what sort of condition the gear was going to be in. Was it still going to be actively fishing, or what was happening with it?
Had you worked with ghost diving before? Did you know about them?
No, I hadn't worked with ghost diving before, but I was aware of them. I followed them on their social medias. So it was actually, I had a look through their social medias, and I was kind of trying to guess whether they'd be able to do something like this. I'd seen them recover some pots before, but I don't think they'd undertaken something on this scale before. So it was actually my dad who made the call, and I think he spoke to Duncan himself, and he was up for giving it a go, eh?
And Duncan, when you received the call, what were your first thoughts? I mean, have you undertaken retrieval this large before?
I was actually in Greece with the Ghost Diving Global team lifting nets, and I received a call from Andy's dad, Graham, and it wasn't a very good line. And I know, and he was talking about the number that they'd lost, and I was a bit taken back. You know, I was kind of thinking our normal sort of operations, I would find discarded fishing gear and we lift it, you know, and we occasionally get reports of like 5 or 10 pots that are missing like a line. So when we heard it was over 500, 600 pots, I was at first, I kind of didn't really think it was something we could cope with on my own. Didn't think we were really set up for that, you know. So what was said was we'd come up and have a look and see if we could help, and we'd just basically just come up and meet the guys and find out what the conditions are like and see how deep it was, see how what sort of boats we could get access to, you know, what the conditions were like. So we just agreed to have a look over the phone.
And what are the conditions like in that area?
Yeah, I mean, it was winter time when Duncan came up. I think the first dive he done was in December. So I think he'll maybe tell you a bit more about the actual diving conditions. But it was winter months that they came up and done most of the diving, which was a surprise to us. It was really surprising the conditions they managed to work in. You just can't thank them enough for coming up.
So we went for a look, and obviously it's December in the UK. The water temperature is probably about 6-7 degrees. So that's like a factor. It wasn't too deep. You're probably talking 10 to 15 meters, and it's variable basically. I mean, we went up about 6 times on one of the dives. You're talking like zero visibility because it's in tight to the shore and there's a lot of swell. So there's a lot of silt and sand getting kicked up, but you can barely see anything. But then on other dives, like the visibility was really good. So over the space from probably December to June that we went up there on 6 different occasions, we experienced quite a few different conditions, you know. But it's generally cold water, not too deep. You can get bits of swell and there's bits of current, you know. But obviously in December in Scotland, it's cold.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even comprehend going into water that cold, also with cold outside temperatures. Like that, it to me is just beyond comprehension. I'm not a cold water in person. I'm kind of a wuss in that regard, but that's impressive. So how do you even locate where the pots are? I mean, you have a vast sea in front of you. Like, where do you begin? It's a needle in a haystack.
None of the pots really stayed where they were set. It was several days, probably weeks, that we were over the cliffs looking out with binoculars, trying to spot some marker buoys. Went out in the boat, just scanning the area back and forth, trying to locate these buoys. There was a few that was actually washed right ashore and at the rocks, so we had to retrieve them and dispose of the gear. And then there were some marker buoys we found that were from different sets of pots, but they were wrapped tight together. So on the end of that bunch, we knew there was at least maybe 50 from different sets of gear.
And so the buoys were then able to remain afloat.
Yeah, that was really beneficial. I mean, that was one saving grace of the whole thing. We were actually really lucky in that regards that the buoys stayed on, so we were actually able to locate gear in different areas.
Duncan, you had mentioned that you didn't think it would be possible to retrieve all these pots. What made it possible?
Well, some of our challenges are we need a dive boat, and we didn't think there was a dive boat in the area. And I thought that would be a challenge because normally dive skippers are used to diving operations and they know procedures, etc. So I thought that was going to hinder her. And obviously the pure number of the pots that were missing, that's like, it could be weeks, days worth of work, you know. Obviously we're all volunteers as well. And the Moray Firth is a long way away from where I live personally, and most of the volunteers, you know, the guys, the rest of the guys from Ghost Diving UK, it's like 6 hours away driving. So it's a long way away, and it's a remote area, and there isn't really any dive charters. But ironically, I think that's what made it possible, is the fact that if we decide to dive off the lobster boat, is it possible to physically dive off a boat that's designed for picking up lobster pots? You know, it's not designed for diving. There's no dive lift. It's not set up for that. But ironically, it's perfect for this task, because once you've figured out a way to get on and off it safely, and you've got the people on the boat with the local knowledge of the area who know where the pots are, who know the currents, they know the weather, they know the tides, they know any dangers in the area, like whether the wind's blowing in a dangerous direction towards a reef. Once you've worked that out, and they've also got a one-ton hauler on the boat as well. So in some cases, you know, once we get one end of the discarded pots lifted up, they can actually start hauling pots in and pulling rope in. So I think without using that, it wouldn't have been physically possible for a team of divers to actually do that. You know, you need to have the divers working with the fishermen using the boat that's designed to bring the kit on together, you know. I think it was like the collaboration that made this possible. If divers had just turned up and said, we're going to take these out, it just wouldn't have happened. It had to be two teams working together with the lobster boat. For me, that's what made it possible.
Oh, so cool. And you had said it was over the time period of like December to June or something.
Yeah, I mean, we made six trips, I think. I counted six, seven. One, we got blown out and just, you know, we're just in the local area. We couldn't dive. It was obviously November, December, January, February, March, April, May. In the UK, the weather's volatile. You know, you have to have a lot of things aligned to make this happen. You have to have good weather. You have to have the volunteers have to have time off. Andy and Graham have to be free so we can use their boats. You know, lots of things have to come together. And I think we got lucky, basically. So we've got a lot of decent weather, you know, which allowed us to sort of carry on. But I mean, some of the lifts were extremely problematic. So you were finding like clumps of 100 pots mashed up together and then trying to lift at the surface. And then like Graham and Andy and Brian, the fishermen, were talking hours and hours of cutting pots off on the surface and then hauling them in one by one on a hook. I mean, that could take hours. That's almost harder than the diving part, you know. Other times, you know, you're swimming about underwater with rope, like hundreds of meters of rope just spread all over the place. In those cases, you're actually cutting pots off under the water and sending them up where they're taken out on bags. So there was lots of different scenarios, and each lift was sort of deciding the best way to do it. But I think it worked. In the end, it worked out really well. And like I say, using, like working with the local fishermen worked out, made it possible, basically. Obviously, we've got a vested interest in getting the discarded gear out of the water, and obviously they've got an interest in getting their gear back as well. But even though we've got different reasons for doing it, it worked out great. So yeah, it's good.
That's great. And you mentioned a gentleman named Gareem. Andy, that's your father, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. My dad was out a lot of dives with Duncan as well as Ryan as well. So at times I wasn't available. So he was out with another fisherman, a friend, Ryan. He came out and helped us in several times. So over the course of the dives, there's kind of the three of us that were involved with Duncan and the rest of the ghost diving team. But as Duncan says, they made six or seven trips up, but several of those trips were 2-3 days at a time. So I really appreciate, obviously, Duncan taking the time off and coming up, as well as everybody else who volunteered. I mean, everybody was a massive help. There was no complaints and everybody was willing to help.
So they're lobster pots. They're designed to trap lobster or whatever else might get in them. Duncan, what kind of animals were you finding when you were coming upon the pots that were inside of them?
Yeah, I mean, what we tend to find with discarded lobster pots that aren't being, you know, actively removed and is that you find everything. You'll find a little fish in there. You'll find two or three crabs. You'll find two or three lobsters. They'll typically like attack each other, and then something else will go in to eat what's been attacked. Sometimes they're just full. They're full of life. And obviously it stays there. It never comes out.
So they essentially, I mean, if you don't take them out of the water, they essentially starve to death.
Well, they'll either starve to death or eat each other, you know. Something else will go in to eat that. But yeah, effectively some of them are just trapped and they'll just die, you know. I think on one occasion, Chris, one of the guys, he pulled like a pregnant crab out of one of the pots, you know, which obviously these guys have quotas and regulations and stuff of what they can take. It's designed to be sustainable, and that pregnant crab went straight back in the water, you know, which is pretty satisfying. Obviously, there's a lot of, if the stuff that's caught, which is not being monitored, it's like below size, you know, and that's returned to the water, you know. Otherwise, it would just sit there and they would just carry on catching continuously until something was done. Obviously, in this case, nothing would be done. It would just be left to rot for like years and years and years, you know. And also, like, the Moray Firth is famous for dolphins. You can actually watch them from the shore, you know. And there's obviously seals about and stuff like that, which you can find many cases online of seals being trapped, and even some cases whales being trapped in discarded rope that's just floating loose in the water. That's obviously a hazard that we were keen this coast diving to remove. It can be dangerous, you know.
It's dangerous for the boats too. The motors can get caught up, and you know, it's just dangerous for everyone.
Well, yeah, there's a few times when, because of so much line in the water, there's a few times that the prop of our boat got trapped up in line. So you have to send like a diver down underneath the boat to cut all that out. Otherwise you're stuck, you know.
Did anything happen to you guys while you were doing this work?
Yeah, just when we were recovering the gear for the top of the water, Duncan and the team were sending up sort of recovery bags. And
they were sending up what?
They were sending up recovery bags. So there was like a clump of rope with several different creels all hanging from that. So each creel is around about 15 to 20 kilos hanging from this. Although the bags are floating on the surface of the water, we need to grab the rope and then tie off one, cut that free from the lump of rope, and then be able to haul that over the rail. So as we're doing that, there was so much rope in the boat that the creel sort of fell over the rail back in the water, and the clump of rope went up around the leg and was pulling me towards the side of the boat. And Chris, another diver, he stepped in and just cut the rope and freed my leg from that.
The rope wrapped around your leg and was pulling on you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, just we don't usually have, obviously, that amount of rope on the boat, or you'd never be standing on top of the rope when you're shooting away gear. But just with the circumstances, with us trying to haul these creels over the rail, that the weight of the creel sort of fell back and up around my leg and pulled me towards the rail, pulled me towards the side of the boat. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's really scary. Yeah, this is not easy work that you guys do.
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to. I just say when we're diving, you know, it's like an underwater puzzle, really. You've got like hundreds of meters of rope spread out with pots, sometimes clumped up. Sometimes they're like in lines, you know. And the problem is, if you fire one up, then you lose the line. So then you can't just surface. You have to like take bearings and things and work out how to get to the next obstruction. And we're trying to decide, you know, is it better to cut them off on the bottom and send them up? But you've only got an infinite amount of time and air on the bottom. Or is it better to take the whole lot, as in big clumps, and send it up and get them cut off on the surface? But obviously the problem is, once they're on the surface, they're held up by bags, and it's a heavy, it can weigh, you know, some of these clumps are like 20, 30 pots held up by bags. And as soon as you take the bag away, it sinks, you know. And there were some occasions where, like, you know, the gear was just sinking again because it was too heavy for the bags. And at some points we had divers like underneath with a hook would come off the boat. A diver would swim underneath the gear and cut one pot off and then hook it onto a line. That's it. And then the fisherman would then pull that one pot onto the boat. And you'd have to do that like a pot at a time, you know, and you're talking like 50, 60 pots in some cases. And obviously if there's any swell on the boat or someone cuts the wrong rope, you can lose gear. And obviously, as Andy said, in some cases, you know, someone can get trapped in a rope or be under the pot when it goes down, you know. So, you know, you just got to be careful when you're doing it. But that's where you try and work together. If someone's one person in the water and one person on the boat, in some cases, the stuff's like, it's in a line. But I think the power of this storm, which at one point Andy said to me, he said, oh, down there is kelp. And there'll be like a load of pots in the kelp. And we went down and it was just sand. There was just like 2 or 3 foot of sand. And like the whole line was just buried in sand, you know, it actually changed the bottom of the sea basically by just lumping tons and tons of sand over that area, which was previously kelp forest and now was effectively under like sand underwater, you know.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's an even bigger ecological disaster than I originally thought. Oh my goodness. So, Andy, were all of your pots retrieved?
Yeah, Doug and the team managed to get them all back. There was a lot of them that was damaged beyond repair, but we managed to get them back out of the water, got them retrieved, and then, yeah, we were actually just working through our way fixing some of them. I had to buy some, obviously, replacement gear, so working with replacement gear just now, and the winter project this year is going to dispose of.
But still, that's a lot that you were able to retrieve. Good luck with fixing them up this winter. So what's next for you guys? What's next for you, Andy, and you, Duncan?
Yeah, that's the plan for me. Just continue fishing just now. And then once the winter sets in, probably before November, just because I don't know, I'll take any chances again. I hope I never see a storm like Storm Arwen again. But it'll just be a case of working in the store through the winter and going fishing days we can. But the priority this winter will be just trying to prepare as much gear as we can ready for next year.
And you, Duncan?
Yeah, well, we continue on with mission. You know, we're supported by Healthy Seas, Pascal Ghost Diving, you know, in the Netherlands. He supports me. We still get reports in of ghost gear from fishermen. Even while we were going to Berghead, we were still getting reports in from Eyemouth. So in between like the Berghead mission, we were like going down to Eyemouth and going out there and collecting pots and rope, because they were obviously hit by Storm Arwen as well. You know, I think it was rumoured that there's something like £750,000 worth of fishing gear still lost in the North Sea as a result of that storm, because it didn't only hit the Moray Firth, it hit all down the coast, you know. Where I live, there's trees being flattened and woods being flattened on land. So, yeah, we're still receiving reports. We're still actively getting out. Obviously, we sort of drew a sort of line under the Berghead, working with Andy, etc. But, you know, we just continue doing what we're doing, retrieving ghost gear. And I know at the end of the retrieval for Andy, he actually took us out to dive. We had an email from someone saying there was discarded fishing nets on two shipwrecks in the Moray Firth. So Andy very kindly took us out and we did surveys on a big famous Scottish shipwreck and also like a famous Scottish submarine wreck in there. And we found five or six nets on those. So we had a plan to go back and remove those because obviously they cause a big problem, you know, discarded fishing nets. So at the minute we're planning to do that, and hopefully we can do that with the use of Andy's very kindly offered to use his boat, you know, and his expertise in the area to go back and do that. And it would be nice to have like the rest of the ghost diving teams come from abroad, you know, and we could maybe have a big mission to lift those in the Moray Firth, you know.
That would be great. I hope you're able to get as many of those nets and gear out. And Andy, thank you for offering to help. It's invaluable. According to what Duncan says, having your equipment and your boat makes all the difference. So it's been wonderful chatting with you guys today. I love hearing about such a wonderful example of collaboration between fishers and environmental groups like Ghost Diving and Healthy Seas. Thank you for your diligence and hard work, and good luck in the future.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks very much for having us on. Thank you very much, and I wish you all the best as well.
Thanks for diving into the Healthy Seas podcast with me. I'm your host, Crystal DiMicelli, and I was just chatting with Duncan Simpson and Andy Jack. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe and review it on your favorite podcasting app. I'll catch you next time. Healthy Seas is a nonprofit on a journey from waste to wear. Founded in 2013, the organization aims at reducing marine litter caused by lost fishing gear through cleanup, prevention, and education activities. The nets collected by Healthy Seas are subsequently reused and recycled and used by its partners for the creation of new products.